ahead. Well, thank you for hopping on here and hanging around for comments. I'm sorry I didn't get to you sooner. And I hope you feel better soon. I hope the swelling goes down and everything gets back under control soon. And look forward to talking to you later on down the log. I'm glad you were finally able to hop in for comments. It's been a long time. I'm going to guess it's probably been about 3 months now. I can't remember exactly when you went for surgery, but I know it's been a while. But thank you for hanging around for comments. And hopefully see you sometime soon. K4OIM, KJ4WZM. 73 as well. Have a good night. Now check in. Alpha through Zulu, A through Z, call KJ4WZM. So, WDARON, you still around? Call KJ4WZM.
RON. I've been listening to all of it. Good to hear Walt. He's really improving. I've been trying to figure out what kind of antenna to put up for my HF. I'm starting to look now at a couple of them. Long wire. And I'm wondering if anybody's had experience with long wires out about 500 feet.
I definitely have not. I have not even heard of them. Haven't heard of that antenna ever. But if anyone else has, they're free to jump in. Does anyone have any comments for Lee or Don? Call KJ4WZM or WD8RON.
RON, I know the club over in Hendersonville has been using one, and I've heard some good things about it. I've got a bunch of trees, so I'm not quite sure how many trees I can go through with an insulated wire and still have a good signal. The other thing in looking through antennas, I found one in an old edition of QST back in March of 16, and it's entitled An Efficient 2-Meter Antenna Disguised as a TV Satellite Dish. He takes a TV satellite dish and makes a 2-meter antenna out of it so he can essentially disguise it.
Seen an article with that done before. It may have been in QST. I've definitely heard of that. And it is somewhat directional as well.
Come in. It's KC4EZ and Google that. There are a couple of YouTube videos out there that talk about how that works. And at least those folks seem to think it works pretty well. The directional part of it comes from the fact that it is basically an off-center fed dipole. And I'll leave it at that because there's some other things. It's basically called a slot antenna, and a slot is a hole. And in order to attach a piece of coax to the hole, you have to put some metal around the edge of the hole. And, of course, that's what turns into your satellite dish. But just Google that, and there's a couple of really good YouTube videos out there on that. As far as the long wire goes, that's just exactly what it is. It is a long wire. It is not resonant. Just remember that going to have a pretty good ground, and every part of that antenna radiates, and that includes your ground wire too. But I know some hams up here who have used one because one guy had where his shack was, the closest tree was several hundred feet down his driveway, and so that's what he put up, but he used it for several years. So don't knock it, but just remember what you've got. Everything radiates, and you're probably going to have a tuner to make it work right. But if you've got the room for it, it's the simplest of the antennas. It's KC4EZM.
RON, I found an article where the author had run it through the computer as to how many half wavelengths. And he's got links not to use and links to use to try to avoid the problem of not having the right number of wavelengths in it.
I've read an article like that. My favorite portable antenna is an InFed, and there's two ways to look at an InFed antenna. You can go the half-wave InFed, and that is a resonant antenna, and it takes like a 49-to-1 transformer to get its impedance down close to what your radio can work. And then the other InFed antenna is non-resonant, and basically what you do is you stay away from those lengths that are resonant antenna lengths. And the article I read said stay plus or minus 1/8 wavelength away from the resonant. Like you got a 66-foot long antenna, that's basically good for 40 meters. Well, if you go an eighth wavelength longer than that, then it's no longer resonant on 40. You have a different ratio with your transformer. And it works some other places, but yeah, I've seen an article like that. Basically, what you have to remember is which way you're thinking. You're either resonant or you're non-resonant, and don't get them mixed up, because they both work, but you have to remember which one you're using. And with that, I've told you a little bit more than I really know, so I'm going to quit talking. There's some real good articles out there on that. There's a guy down in Australia put out a YouTube video, and he had a 160-meter InFed antenna that they played with, and explained some of the theory really, really well. But anyway, we'll turn that back to you, and time to head out in another direction. KC4WZM, and I don't remember your call, Ron, but I know you're there, and this is KC4EZM.
WD8RON, and sometimes I've been tempted to switch to using the name Ron and then have people wonder how I got the call. Because I pulled out about the best random wire antenna links, and then an article about random wires, and then he's got a chart about what links to use and not to use, and that's rather interesting, because I can put up around close to 500 feet on my property by making a big loop, and he's got one stay far away from a possible, and the number he's got here is 496, and a whole bunch of other numbers to stay away from. However, he's got 423 is one that would be good for a long wire.
Yeah, that 496 rings a bell, because that's in that basic formula that we play with when we're figuring the length of a resonant half-wave antenna. So that's basically one wavelength on some frequency. But yeah, the thing that I've learned is just remember which way that you're working. And as long as you're consistent in your thinking, it's going to work pretty well. But if you, as they say, if you try and change horses in the middle of the stream, you might get wet. That's the only advice I give there. Just remember which way you're thinking. And again, if you've got 500 feet, there's nothing wrong with running out a whole long length of wire, because you can always fold it back on itself and make the antenna shorter till you get something that you're happy with, and then you just leave it. My definition of the perfect antenna is the one that does what you want to do at your house. And the antenna that I have at my house, if I took it down and put it up at your house, it would either work better or worse. And we won't know which one it is until we put it up. So that's just sort of my general philosophy on antennas. I don't get too hung up on some of these detailed designs, but the ones that work and sometimes you have to play with them and find out what works at your place. Anyway, I'll turn it back to you and Daniel, and I'll remember it next time. Anyway, it's KC4EZN. We'll be clear.
Say again, please. Over.
Oh, and Ed, I was just messing with you. I called you Ron. Go ahead.
Change the subject for Daniel. Talking about heat can be very dangerous, particularly the degrees he's talking about. It wasn't a heat stroke, but it was some damage when I was in airborne. What they did then is something that he might be able to do. They had low showers, and every hour we would crab walk through the showers to wet our uniforms, everything except the boots. An hour later, they'd be bone dry. This was down at Fort Benning, down in Georgia. The other thing is there are several things on the market where you wet them down and put them around your neck, and they really work good. I used the shower technique when I was doing some roofing. I had a long sleeve felt shirt. I'd wet it down to the point just above where it was dripping and wear that, and that would cool down a whole lot because it affects access and evaporator.
There. That might help out a good bit, actually. WDARON, KG4WZM. Yep, and one of the things I found is during the summer, at first, the heat just hits me like a ton of bricks. It's very exhausting. I kind of struggle with coping with it a little bit. I'll get cramps, headaches, dehydration especially. It takes me a little while to learn how much water to drink. And then I start getting used to it, and then I'm more okay. It's not that the heat is pleasant by any means, but I'm able to deal with it a whole lot better once I get acclimated to it. And then winter's a real shock, but I honestly do much better with the cold than I do the heat anyways. I'll get adjusted to it, and it'll be okay, but it takes me about 2 to 3 weeks of actual decent heat, 90-plus degrees, and then I adjust.
Adjust to it, but the headaches and all bother me. If you're turning red and stuff like that, you may be getting heat stroke. Once you have something like that, you can never really get rid of it, just like frost damage or cold damage. Once you've got cold damage, you've always got it. I've got hands and ears that I messed up, and I can't go out in the real cold without gloves or earmuffs because I'll feel it real fast.
Oh, okay. I was not aware of that. Thankfully, I haven't ever gotten frostbite or near frostbite ever. But I bet that would do it.
Forget that. It wasn't frostbite, but frost damage, and my hands will still feel it. If I go out in around 30 degrees, I better have some gloves on. But the heat damage, you might want to do some reading about heat dangers, because it sounds like temperatures you're working at, you need to do something else. Like, I've got a gadget that's a cooling hood, actually. You wet it down and put it over your whole head and neck. And the other thing is a tube that goes around my neck. And I've used both of those, and they work pretty good. Something you might explore.
Definitely check that out. I've worked in a lot of hot conditions before. Very, very miserable hot conditions. I don't know if that plays any kind of a role in it or not. Also, I used to ride my bicycle in really hot weather and got absolutely exhausted from that multiple times, riding way too far, way farther than I should have been in those conditions, like 100-plus mile rides, and got a lot of muscle cramps and bulges through that kind of stuff, and then all the next night and the next day I'd have random muscles locking up and stuff like that. That happened to me when I was younger, much younger, several years ago. But I wonder if that is the kind of heat damage that you're referring to.
What the long-term symptoms are. If your legs are cramping up now, you might try something I use because my legs cramp up at night. It's called ThermaWorks, WRXTATRA Works. It's a cream, or actually a foam. You put that on and it's effective within about a couple of minutes and will stop the cramps.
I didn't have any leg cramps last night or anything. My neck cramped up really bad, and that hurt really badly this morning when I woke up. I got some ibuprofen this morning shortly after I got to work, and then that cleared up. But now I'm going to keep that with me.
Hey, the works, thermal works on neck, but it should work there also. You want to be careful with ibuprofen stuff because that can have some long-term effects also.
It pretty sparingly, once every few months or so I'll use some of it when I get muscle cramps or whatever. But one of the things I've noticed over time is a contributing factor to the cramping issue is sodium and potassium imbalances. My sodium and potassium levels have a tendency to fall too low. And once I get those boosted back up, then I don't get the muscle issues as much.
Try drinking tonic water rather than just plain water. The tonic water seems to help by putting whatever is tonic to quinine stuff into your system.
Oh dear, I'll try that.
Heard you talking about the heat. I immediately thought about some of the things I've experienced and seen that you want to be very careful with it because it sounds like you're right on the dangerous edge.
I've never gotten heat stroke. I know that it's a real thing, and the National Weather Service always talks about, you know, the dangers and symptoms of heat stroke, blah, 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 so on and so forth. And if you see someone struggling with symptoms of heat stroke, move them to a cool place, drink plenty of water, and seek medical help, and all that kind of stuff. All those things that they say once the heat index reaches above 100 degrees, and they put out those heat advisories and stuff. I remember all those things that they talk about on there, so that is one of them.
Had a black ball on a thermometer, and I don't know exactly what the relationship was. You had a table that you went through. At a certain point, much of the activities, the physical activities, would slow down or even stop based on the index.
Interesting. One thing I let the mic go for a second. One thing that I've noticed lately is that a number of the construction sites that I've been going to have been wrapping their day up at around 3 o'clock instead of working much later into the day like they were doing earlier. When daylight started increasing, they were working until 6, 7, or even later in the evening, 8 almost, and then calling it quits. But now that it started getting hot, a lot of these sites have been wrapping up at 3 and going home.
The temperatures are around that time of day. It builds up during the day, and then around 3, 4, that's when the hot temperatures are. You might check at work. Do some reading about the heat index and see if they have some kind of a heat index indicator at work. We call it a black ball. I don't know what it would call in civilian life.
I know a lot of these places. I go to many, many different construction sites done by many, many different people. It's not just ours. I rarely go to our own sites, but I haul construction materials to a whole bunch of different construction companies, dozens of different companies, and quite a number of them recently have been completing their work day at 3 o'clock and going home, just, I think in part because of the heat. They've been wrapping up really early. They're like, we're going to get to this tomorrow, and I'll show up at 3 o'clock, they're like, we were about to go home, and then you show up. I'm like, yeah, well. So, I was just noticing that, though, because that's hugely different than how things had been when the daylight had started increasing again, and we were having daylight until 8 o'clock, because they were working until 8, and then it started getting hot, and then they cut it way back.
Which was a colonial writer, politician, and he did all kinds of things, a plantation owner. He would get up around, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and that's when he would do most of his work. He had to do it by candlelight, but that's when he would do most of it, so that the afternoons he could either nap or whatever. And the same way with the field hands, they wouldn't go out and work when it was real late like that. That was in Virginia. That was back in the late 1600s.
Museum. That's really interesting. Yeah, I do like the weather that time of day, and it's so peaceful in the morning too. That's one thing I do miss is when I worked for the beer company. I started my work day at about 4 a.m. there, and it was really nice and calm and peaceful in the morning. Even if it was a hot day, the temperatures were a whole lot more tolerable then, and I'd try to get as much done as possible before 10 a.m. because it would start feeling hot because of the humidity around 10, and then the actual heat would kick in afternoon, and oh man, that was rough, just trying to finish up the last of it. So I try to knock out as much as I could at the beginning prior to the day when it was cool. That way I could slow down and take my time more once it was hotter, because I hated working way too hard in the sun. Unloading those side loader trucks is a lot of work, way more than what you think. It looks tedious and it looks difficult, but wow, that's an awful job.
A break here. I want to see if I can find the name of that cool device I was talking about, and there might be something you can look up there. Relatively inexpensive, $10 to $15, $20, but definitely worth it. So I'll take a break here, turn it back to you, and I'll see if I can find those.
Quick call for any additional check-ins. I'll still be here. Are there any additional check-ins? A through Z, call KJ4WZM.
Control, please check in Kilo Oscar 4, Papa, X-ray Bravo, Lloyd in Simpsonville, Axie Mobile.
Kilo Oscar 4, Yankee Kilo Tango, KO4YKT, Mark and Inman.
KO4PXB, that is Lloyd in Simpsonville, and KO4YKT, Mark and Inman. Any other stations? Alpha through Zulu, A through Z, call KJ4WZM. Sounds like that wraps it up for now. WD8RON, KJ4WZM, are you back around, Don? My bad.
XB.
Go ahead, Lloyd.
About the information for the what times work, if you'll actually Google it, heat Black Flag Index, and it'll explain all about it, and it'll even give you a little printout chart that you can do. It's called Black Flag Index.
I didn't even know about that. I had no idea it existed. KF4 PXB KJ4WZM. I had to think about your call.
KO4 PXB, yeah, when the military uses it, and when that the black flag is up, it's actually 10 minutes of work and the 50 minutes of rest.
I don't know that. Do they do that at Fort Jackson a lot? Are you familiar with Fort Jackson in South Carolina?
Yeah, man, they will definitely abide by the heat index. What they'll do is when the black flag is up, they will actually go inside for training. And if it's anything outside, then they will abide by the black flag index, because they definitely don't want a soldier going down, you know, with a heat stroke or worse.
I'm completely unaware of that. That's pretty neat. I had no idea. Thanks for filling me in on that. KO4PXB, KJ4WZM.
Definitely most welcome. The only time that does not come into play, and of course, in a combat situation, because that goes out the window, you just do what you have to do.
WZM, this is WD8RON, over.
And KJ4WZM.
These are. One is a tube, it's got some crystals of some kind, and I've actually seen how you can make your own directions on Google. This is called Cool Thing, with an exclamation mark. It's made by Dan Scott, D-A-N-S-C-O-T-T. And I don't know. Oh, it's got a phone number. Can you write down a phone number?
Yep.
3914-273-4090. This is somewhat old, but I would think it would still be a good number. The other item is like a big bag you can put over your head, around your neck. It's got half a dozen different ways of wearing it and using it. And it's called a mission. And if, let me put my magnifying glass on this tag. And it's made by MP USA Limited. And it's got a number, RN149987, which I guess is their model number. And let's see, it doesn't have directions on here. Basically, you soak it and then put it on, and that helps you to cool, just like we used to put bags on water on front of cars going across the desert, and then we would put, they would hang outside on the radiator, and they were made out of burlap, and you wet them down, and they would evaporate and keep it cool.
Were you in the military?
I did not realize that. Actually, we may have talked before. I forgot about that. Yeah, I think you did.
Training, airborne ranger, jungle school, stuff like that.
Adventure.
The kind of thing, I'm glad I did it, but I don't want to do it again.
That's for sure. I got another crazy question for you. Planes and stuff, right?
Not that many times, really, only about a dozen, but I did jump. Scared of them, I tend to avoid some of them, like going up towers and stuff, but that's more of a physical thing now because of age. I don't want to end up falling. But going out of a plane, I never really got used to it. Coming down is nice, but going out the door, I never really got used to.
What do you think of hang gliding?
It's like any of those things. You want to get some training in it, and you want to make sure that the people who are training you know what they're doing. It's just like you see advertisements for jumping out of a plane, and they're going to train you in 5 hours how to do it. Some of those are actually a buddy system where they'll strap you in, and they're the ones that control the chute and stuff, so I don't really regard that quite the same way. But you want to have some training. Airborne Army training, I think it still takes 3 weeks for that.
I've researched hang gliding schools before, and there's an extremely well-known one in Tennessee, highly, highly, highly recognized, and that training is weeks long. They have like a hang gliding camp where they teach you from the very, very, very basics all the way up to, I think, a category 3. It starts from 1 and goes to 3, backwards from cycling. It goes to 5. It goes from 1 and goes to 5, but then 4 and 5, are, you just get your hours to get those after you get 3. But they'll take you from level 1 to 3. Cycling is different. Cycling starts at category 5 and goes to 1. 5 being entry level and 1 being pro.
That station is very weak. Again, please. in about airborne. Airborne used to be 3 weeks down at Benning, and a lot of that was training on how to fall, how to land, actually, and what to do with that. Some of that sticks. I've fallen since then in different situations and been able to resort to that, because basically it's just to make it instinctive, so you just do what's required without even thinking about it. Films, you'll see people going out to plane, and it looks like the man standing next to the door, the jump master, is pushing people out the door. Well, he actually is, but he's not pushing them out because they don't want to go. He's pushing them to get them away from the plane so that they don't have any connection to the plane once they're out the door.
Wood, I think has already gone. Ed, good point there about not having a connection to the plane when you jump out. The wind speeds would be absolutely ridiculous with many, many, many pounds of force against somebody's body, and it would take very little time for their body to make contact with the plane in a manner that could cause injury because of the speed of the wind.
On the type of plane, some you go out the side door, the later ones have a ramp and just run down the ramp and out you go. The ones I like are helicopters. You don't get the wind blowing against you so much. You just sit in the door and just lift up and push out.
Now open, pray your chute opens.
Two kinds of jumps. One is free fall, where you pull the ripcord, and a lot of those are from high altitude, so you get close down to around 3,000 feet or so. And the other is the tactical. You have a static line where if you go out the door, that line pulls your parachute out, and you've got a reserve. Although I have several classmates who had problems coming down and had to do the reserves and had problems with those. Some of them had some real problems.
Like that. What happens if both parachutes are messed up?
On television, who will tell you about that? He's one of the charities that's helping him out. Both of them got messed up, and he landed. I don't know how far he fell, but I think he broke both his legs and broke his spine.
That's awful.
Say that if it doesn't work, bring it back, and we'll give you a new one.
Yeah, that's a lot of good.
To deal with if it doesn't open or it does different things, gets tangled up in a certain way, and how to get rid of your main chute so your reserve is not going to get tangled up in that. But yeah, accidents happen.
If I was hang gliding, I think that I would want to take a parachute with me. The problem is, though, getting the parachute clear of the wing in order for it to work. How do you do that?
Some hang gliders that have built-in parachutes, so if something goes wrong, I don't know how you activate it, but in fact your parachute goes off and it brings down the whole business together. Way back they used to use radio control planes, big ones. They'd be 20-foot wingspans. They'd use those as targets for anti-aircraft, and they'd bring those down by parachute. When it ran out of gas, they had deployed the parachute, that would bring down the plane. I don't know if they still use those.
Interesting. Do you know much about hang gliding?
Seen on TV and watched the actual people out in California on the cliff near San Francisco, where you had a lot of winds, and they would just run off the edge of the cliff, and they were a flight.
Interesting. I've seen a lot of videos of them doing that. They play in the wind on that. What I would like to do around here is jump off from one of our local mountains and see if I can ride thermals up to around close to 10,000 feet where the weather is a lot cooler. That's really what I would do it for, is to escape the heat.
For airplanes, for gliders, there are devices you can put in where it's actually a radio-controlled glider, and they will send a sound as to whether you are descending or ascending, so that you know what to do with the plane.
They use those on hang gliders as well. If you want to, there's a video that covers I don't know if it's the United States record or the world record for longest hang glider flight, and they crossed Texas from one inch to the other in one day. If I'm not mistaken, I think they also ran lights on their wing as well, because if you run lights, I think you get one extra hour after sunset as well, if you're running lights, if I'm not mistaken. Or some window of time. You're allowed to run longer with lights than without. But there is a video online documenting the attempt for the Guinness Book of World Records, and he has that beeper on his wing that tells him if he's ascending or descending and how fast it's going. And that's pretty neat. I like watching that sometimes.
Go ahead, please.
Air Force canopy cutting knives. It was made by Camulus in New York and contracted by the Air Force in 1957. But always thought it was pretty cool that I have one of those. But they stopped issuing those in 1993.
I didn't catch the beginning of your transmission. I think I may have missed your call sign as well. Could you come back again with your call? I missed the first half of your transmission.
Kilo 4 Golf Sierra Charlie.
Indeed, RON. He was talking about the Air Force having some kind of equipment. That sounded pretty interesting. I did not get all of his call. I got Kilo 4 Golf Blank Charlie.
K4GSC, that's Brian and Marietta.
Indeed, RON. There was a movie some time ago about an escape from a German prison camp. I don't recall the name of it. They effectively built a glider and used that to escape, and that was before gliders were part of the culture. They launched him out of a tower in some castle, and he was in the mountains, so he had ways to go to escape.
That kind of stuff is really fascinating to me. I really like flying stuff. And I can't afford a $30,000 beginner airplane that needs $30,000 of work either. I can't afford anything like that. It costs a good $50,000-$60,000 even before inflation recently hit to get going into aviation for the most part. But a hang glider is about, you can get one for about $5,000 and get training for about $5,000 as well. So that's $10,000 to get in for that. And it's a lot more than that. I guess it probably costs close to $100,000 now to get your own plane and get the training to get your entry-level license. So I guess it costs 10% as much, but probably 10 times riskier.
Takes, in terms of time or money, to get a private license now, but you do not need to own a plane. You join a group that effectively time shares the planes, and so when you go on a trip, you pay a certain amount based on the days that you have the plane, and so you don't own it. You just compare it to a timeshare for the plane.
I haven't ever heard of that before.
But if you call the nearest private airport, I'm sure they could tell you all about it and what clubs are involved there.
My brother doesn't lack very much on finishing his license for flying, his pilot license. He had some instrument flying hours left to do. I forget how many, but he's close to having his done. But he hasn't flown in a little while now, so some of the hours he had have, I think, expired, so he needs to get some more. But he and I have talked about going halves on a plane together. It'd be cheaper that way.
If you own a plane, it's like a boat. It's a hole in which you pour water. But if you belong to a club, it gets to be a lot less expensive and a lot less headache. You've got to consider insurance, parking, and all that kind of stuff. And that's one thing that if you get a license, if you get life insurance, they want to know if you plan to skydive or fly as a pilot, and your insurance rate will go up.
Which is confusing to me because it'll go up way more than somebody who smokes. But somebody who smokes is way more likely to die than someone who flies.
An interesting observation. I suppose so. It's differently. One, you just not so quietly go off, whereas the other way makes a big splash for headlines.
I mean, it's a rare thing to hear about a pilot getting killed in a crash. There's so few crashes. I mean, it does happen. But think about the number of people that you have known who have died in automobile crashes or died from smoking cigarettes versus the number of pilots that you have even heard of dying. Me personally, I personally have lost way more friends to motor vehicle accidents since I graduated high school than I have heard of total number of pilots crashing.
Small plane accidents, I don't keep track of them as such, but I see them. And usually it's pilot error for lots of reasons, but it happens, and you'll see them in the news once or twice a month if you follow that kind of thing.
No, I haven't really seen a whole lot of that. I heard about one recently where a plane came down to hit a bridge and knocked some cars silly on it as well. I don't think anybody died in that crash, but I know that there were some injuries. And I don't remember where it was, but I know that it was nearby here. I don't think it was South Carolina, but it may have been Georgia or North Carolina or Tennessee. I don't remember.
Big dangers is when people who fly single-engine planes graduate to a dual-engine without a whole lot of training. The dual engine is like driving four horses rather than riding one, and so they end up with problems because things happen faster and bigger.
I was actually unaware of that, and if I was to fly a plane, it's the dual engine type stuff that I am most interested in. I would like to have multiple engines. Every once in a while when I'm at work on a Saturday, I'll see them actually training up in the sky on the dual engine planes. They have a course that takes them right overhead of the shop, and you'll hear them spool the engines up and turn one off and all kinds of stuff like that, then turn both of them off and turn one back on. They'll do that overhead. It's the eeriest thing. You hear the plane, and it stays kind of nearby, but you'll hear both engines on, and then all of a sudden they turn one off, but then they turn the other one off, and then they'll flip one back on, and it's like, oh, wow. And they do it a bunch.
Years ago when the Kennedy died in a plane crash up in the New York area.
Museum. Yes, I've heard of that.
Two problems there. One of them is he had just gone up to a twin-engine plane and had not really had that much training on it. The other was he was flying counter to the weather reports, and there was some background on that as to the cause of that. But he apparently got into a situation in fog or cloud and couldn't really tell what direction he was going in. He didn't follow his instruments, apparently, and you can't really tell whether you're going up or down in a situation like that.
Documentary on that and a depiction of what he would have seen and why things would have gone that way. And I heard the audio playback from that as well and everything. And they tried to walk him through how to use his instruments. And then next thing is they try to make radio contact with him and he's not there anymore. But I had seen that, and actually he was not licensed to be in the plane that he was in. He did not have his instrument flying rating, his IFR. He was supposed to be clear air only. And he was in an IFR situation. He wasn't cleared to take off, but he went and did it anyways.
Pilot error again, and that's why I say the training, just like skydiving or anything else, becomes critical. You can never get enough of the training and keep expanding it. And when people jump, like the classes that you're watching with the dual engine, I will bet you that all those people have a large number of hours in a single engine plane.
Sure. I work in Dacusville, and last Saturday when I was at the shop washing trucks, there was a twin engine plane that stayed in the area for hours and hours and hours. And that's what he was doing, was playing with those engines, turning them on and off, on and off, on and off, practicing controlling the plane with complete power loss and everything. And I was kind of intrigued by it a little bit. Obviously, I couldn't stand there and watch it the whole time. But hearing it, and then all of a sudden the plane has the power turned off, it's kind of an eerie thing. It's like, oh, wow, there's a twin-engine plane up there. First one engine went out, then the other one. Is he okay? And the next thing you know, the engines come back to life. But practicing controlling the aircraft when things go wrong, I suppose, is probably a major key to the training.
Be a large part of it to handle emergencies. I'm going back to bicycles. Do you still ride the bike a lot?
Again, due to the amount of work hours I've gotten myself into, prior to getting my CDL, I rode my bicycle a whole lot, but I was working 8-hour days. But KG4WZM. But now that I'm driving a truck, most of my work days are typically 12, 13, 14, 15 hours, which I'm not really supposed to be at 15 hours, but not all of that was driving anyways. But I've had very, very, very long days recently, and it makes it difficult to ride a bike, because afterwards, there's no daylight left. I go home, and next thing I know, it's dark, and then I'm so tired that I don't really want to get on a bike, so I haven't been doing very much of that. I have thought about riding my bicycle back and forth to work, but I haven't started doing that yet. Been waiting for daylight to get a little bit longer so that I have the sun completely up before I have to leave.
County, Transylvania County is a biker's dream, apparently, but they create all kinds of problems. A lot of them wear dark clothing, which makes them hard to see. I've tried to start a program where people wear bright colors, bright yellow or bright orange, so that automobiles can see them. My wife counted 56 bikes going by the house a week or so ago, and they have a bunch of runs. The Rotary Club here sponsors what's called the Assault on the Carolinas. It's not a race, it's an assault, really. Has two routes, one 50K and one 100K. The 100K goes down into South Carolina, goes across Highway 11, and then comes back up 276. It's about 9 miles up at 9% grade.
Now I'm familiar with the area. I have done a lot of the riding in that area there. I've done many of the mountains around here. I've gone up the Greenville Watershed, up Saluda's grade, all the different climbs around Saluda I've done, both in the valley and up on the hill. I've done Paris Mountain, Caesar's Head is the Highway 276 climb. I've done 178 to Brevard. I've done up to Sassafras Mountain and a whole bunch of other stuff. I've done the whole area, and going all through the North Carolina mountains as well, especially all through the Tuxedo area. I've done a lot of riding up that way through those mountains.
For Assault on the Carolinas, the next event here is going to be in September. it's a big fun time for everybody. We usually have around 1,000 riders.
Sounds good. I might have to check that out and get myself whipped back into shape. That's something that I could go do. That sounds pretty fun. Have you ever heard of the Hincapie Gran Fondo?
By that name, I know there was one this past weekend for going up to Mount Mitchell, and I've heard of one going across the state, but I don't know if what you do is the one you're referring to.
Hincapie Gran Fondo is an 80-mile ride that goes through the mountains in Greenville County, Polk County, and Henderson County, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think it goes into Rutherford at all. It might go into Spartanburg County. I'm not quite sure on that. I know it goes very, very close to Spartanburg County. This goes up through the Landrum area, Tryon area, stuff like that.
For those here in Transylvania, there was one a couple weeks ago. I don't know what the name of it was, but we saw a bunch of bikes, and there will be a lot of times colored lines on the pavement to indicate which route a particular group is following.
Super familiar with those. I've ridden in a lot of those races where they have multiple tiers and it's all painted in the road and stuff like that. I'll watch for those as well when I'm out driving, especially when they show up out of nowhere, because when all of a sudden you see all those different colored arrows, you know there's going to be a cycling event on a nearby weekend, and that gives me a heads up when I'm driving a truck or whatever, because I know that there's about to be a race. We recently had some colored arrows show up by our shop at work, and I subconsciously know exactly what those are. I don't know whose ride that is, but it's going to go right by my work, so I'm going to keep my eyes open tomorrow when I go into work and when I leave.
Up to Mount Mitchell, apparently it goes through some kind of national or state park. Some of the riders ran into a problem with one of the agents, because he said the regulations require that they have headlights, flashing headlights, and some of the bikes did not have that. They finally convinced him that because of the event, he should let them all go, which he did. But apparently that's something that you have to watch out for. I like the headlights and the taillights and the bright shirts, because we can't get around them. With the curves, the hills here, once you get behind a bike, you're liable to go 2 or 3 miles before you can get around them.
DM, when I was cycling, I had, before I had a cycling coach, I had some extremely bright LED lights and big battery packs on my handlebars. These lights were every bit as bright as a modern day car. Every bit as many lumens. They were very, very, very bright lights with a spread out beam pattern. The beam pattern on the roadway, it literally looked like oncoming there was like a BMW or an Audi or something with the amount of light that I was shedding off of the bike like that ahead of me. And then I had some very bright flashing taillights as well. And my bike was very visible. I actually, for a while, I felt safer riding that thing at night than I did in the daytime, because nobody ever pulled out in front of me. I had a tendency to be riding very fast on my bike. I've always been thrilled with going high speeds or covering a long distance in a short amount of time. I tend to ride my bicycle a lot faster than most of the other bicycles that are around, and I had this problem with cars making left-hand turns or pulling straight out in front of me. But at night, that never happened once. I got flashed a lot with headlights because my lights were way too bright, but I figured to myself I'd rather have drivers flashing with me with their headlights because my lights are too bright than running right up over top of me because they can't see me. And then I got a cycling coach, and he said, oh, you shouldn't be having all that weight on your handlebars, and got all mad at me for it, made me take all that stuff off. Well, then I decided I wouldn't have him as a coach anymore, and I never did put my lights back on, but I'm planning on putting them back on again.